Orson Welles, usually heard at this time each Sunday afternoon, has been called to Mexico City on business connected with the current production of his motion picture. In his absence, the American Broadcasting Company presents Cary Longmire, foreign correspondent and ABC Washington commentator, speaking from Washington. Mr. Longmire.
For anyone interested in the real problems of our times, one can recommend some words written by an old and stooped Frenchman, one of the legitimate great men of modern days. That Frenchman's name is Léon Blum. 40 years ago, Blum was a young writer in Paris, campaigning for justice for a man named Dreyfus, the French army officer, who happened to be a Jew, who was framed by higher-ups in the French army and sent to Devil's Island, accused of being a spy, a traitor. France split sharply on that Dreyfus case. There were some who said, why bother anyway about what happens to a mere Jew? Then there were the flaming fighters for justice, men like Zola, the novelist, Blum, the slender young writer, and canny old Georges Clemenceau, who in 1918, during the First World War, became the savior of France. All those Frenchmen battled to save the obscure young army officer. Finally, Dreyfus was released, acclaimed throughout the world as the martyred victim of ruthless prejudice and a plot by the generals to drum up public sentiment in favor of the army's high command. The young Léon Blum soared to fame in that long battle for an obscure army man. Blum was a socialist. Eventually, in 1936, he became premier of all France. French labor unions at that moment were riding high, demanding an end to the old dominance of 200 rich French families, the 200 families who controlled the Bank of France and who hadn't much cared, therefore, just who happened to run the French government. By threatening to stop the government's money, those 200 French families could always keep the politicians in tow. Léon Blum, the scholarly socialist, tried his best at the head of the French government. He put through all kinds of reforms, the 40-hour week, for instance, and compulsory vacations for workers. He tried to trim the huge power of the 200 families and of the Bank of France. All this might have worked. It might have produced a better nation in France if it hadn't been for a fellow named Adolf Hitler. Just across the border over in Germany, Hitler and his Nazis were furiously arming. They shouted threats against the entire world. They cried that Germans were the master race, destined to rule the earth. While Socialist Blum in France fought for liberty for French workers, for more vacations with pay and social security and all the rest of it, the Germans, for their part, were making guns. And, tragically enough, the French socialists were so intent on building a paradise of their own in their own nation that France did very little to try and stop the Nazis. When Hitler started war openly in 1939, France was almost defenseless. Millions of French workers didn't want to give up those easy hours of labor they had won. French millionaires, for their part, shouted that they would much rather have Adolf Hitler than Léon Blum in Paris. In 14 days in 1940, the Nazi armies swept through France like a knife cutting through butter. France collapsed from its own weakness. Today, Léon Blum is an old man, but still a fighting man. His autobiography has just been published. And today, in his 70s, he is reflecting over his party's and his country's political errors. His words apply equally well to the world's mistakes. Here is what he says. I quote his own words. In the early days of socialist propaganda, fierce and implacably combative as it was, we reached great moral heights. He goes on, we fought together against danger in a common spirit of self-sacrifice that exalted our faith. Then the risks grew less. Faith was dulled. And the old Frenchman whose nation was overrun by the Germans says, we had become too strong and less careful. We had slipped gradually into the mold of ordinary life. We had become too successful. And when the time came, when the nation was waiting for a rallying cry, a call to action, there was none in our ranks great enough to voice it. That analysis, it would seem, would apply almost equally to the whole democratic world today, to America and to Britain, to an America and a Britain who have just emerged victorious in the greatest war of all history. But now, what has happened? Is anyone in America and Britain really confident that the peace will last? Well, hardly anyone. Every thinking person throughout the globe is terrified that a new war may break at any moment. Down at Oak Ridge, Tennessee, and elsewhere, the atomic bomb plants are working furiously, turning out the awful weapons which destroyed Hiroshima and which sent warships to the bottom of the sea in the atomic tests recently at Bikini. American statesmen and Russian statesmen, Americans and Yugoslavs, Americans and the leaders of one contending faction in China are waging a jittery war of nerves against each other. In the present worldwide battle for power with Russia, the Anglo-American bloc is not taking really decisive steps, though, to spread democracy. All we're doing is trying to hang on to what we've got. We're trying to do just about what French labor unions did in the 1930s in the face of the danger of aggression from Hitler, simply to protect advantages already won. We're jealously guarding our riches while failing, really, to spread the democratic system in the world so as to create a greater safety for ourselves in the long run. And more wars are inevitable as long as the world is torn as it is today by fears and poverty and starvation. Léon Blum's tragic confession of the failure of France in the face of the threats of Hitler ought to be chalked up, it would seem, in huge letters in our own State Department here in Washington and over in London in the British Foreign Office. What tactics should we be following then? Well, first, it must be stated baldly and quite frankly that what America is doing today is to wage war, a war of propaganda and diplomacy against Russia. That's the big political fact of life in our times. We are scared of the Russians and the spread of communism, and the Russians are equally scared of us. So, America and Russia are fighting a bitter battle of words and of threats, of power politics, everywhere on earth today. Whether you and I happen to like it or not, that is exactly what is happening. That being the case, the only question is, how are we going to win that battle without actual armed war? Without a new atomic Armageddon in which half the earth might be blown up and civilization destroyed? Well, if we'll follow the advice of Léon Blum, who wrote his thoughtful words while locked in a Vichy prison fighting for his very life, we will go on the offensive with a slashing campaign for liberalism and for real democracy all over the globe. We are not doing that today. Today, Athens in far-off Greece is tense. Unhappy Greece is torn by mortal feuds, the feud between royalists on one side and Democrats on the other, with the communists in the middle trying to stir up riots and bloodshed to gain advantages for themselves. At least 50 persons there in Greece have already been killed in rioting. Greece is a big arena. It's obvious in the big worldwide battle between democracy and communism. What the Greeks are voting on today is whether they want a king or not. British guns and British tanks and British bayonets have exerted pressure there in Greece ever since the war's end for one purpose, to bring back the king and, incidentally, put down the communists. But what business have we and the British, if we really are trying to bring democracy to the Greeks, what business have we to try and cram a king down the Greek people's throats? This same King George of Greece, whom the hungry Greeks are voting on today, is the same man who, just a few years ago, helped put a ruthless dictator into power. That dictator, named Metaxas, ruled by the whip. Greek Democrats, men and women who spoke their minds and wanted a better government, were seized by secret police in the night. They disappeared, never to be heard of again. The king, this same King George, sat by during all this. He backed Metaxas in every way. And what kind of idiotic nonsense is it for us to back that kind of candidate in Greece today in the name of democracy? That is simply playing into the hands of the Russians. By putting our blessing on the king who once set up a fascist dictatorship, we're not helping the cause of democracy in any way. We're making inevitable a huge growth in the party of the Greek communists, who eventually, as a result, may then rise up and seize control of Greece. And where will we be then in that global battle of ours with Soviet Russia? If we're trying to promote democracy, in other words, why not really promote it in Greece? Yet today it's revealed that this week, on Thursday, the 130 war planes of our biggest and newest aircraft carrier, the Franklin D. Roosevelt, now on a Mediterranean cruise, will fly over Athens. Fly over Athens at the specific request of the Greek government in a tight little demonstration of American armed might. That conservative Greek government wants those planes in the air on Thursday merely to show that America backs up King George, who expects to win in today's election, and to persuade any would-be rebels that they had better think twice before revolting. What the Russians are really interested in down there in that part of the world, of course, is control of the Dardanelles. They have been putting all the pressure possible on Iran and on Turkey to win a commanding position astride that vital strait. If Moscow can get a foothold in Greece, which also stands near the Dardanelles, she will certainly make every attempt to do so. Léon Blum says flatly that the French socialists failed in the time of real crisis to issue a rallying call for action. Well, are we in Britain failing in just the same way, in Greece and in China and elsewhere around the globe? We certainly aren't helping our cause in the propaganda battle with Russia around the world by such stupid actions as that in Germany last week. There in Germany, in Frankfurt, our army made 15 arrests. The sensational story was given out that we'd caught a huge spy ring, the ringleaders of a Free Germany committee, which, the army said, was plotting for German freedom under the prodding of Moscow. The world was given to understand that the 15 were plotting for Russian aims. No one stopped to figure out, apparently, that you could hardly call a German, an enemy of ours, a spy for an allied nation. And to say the least, how could American officials expect anything else but for Germans to want a free Germany again? Well, today the army confesses, quite abashed, that its gigantic spy ring sensation has fizzled out completely. There was no connection at all, the army now finds, with Moscow. Germany is the place where the Anglo-American battle of power politics with Russia is going on at its hottest. Yet General McNarney saw fit the other day to issue a heated statement accusing the Russians of plotting in Germany for socialism, of plotting to destroy capitalism. Just what, in heaven's name, does the general expect a Russian communist to do except plot against capitalism? Yesterday, a congressional committee over in Tokyo issued a report. It was a House Military Affairs Committee. It got so jittery over the situation out in the Far East and alleged Russian threats against America's position there that the party of touring congressmen said that there was imminent danger of another Pearl Harbor there in the Pacific. Those congressmen demand immediate strengthening of our bases all through the Pacific area. Yet the Russians are in no position to open actual armed warfare. Russia is still too badly crippled from the war. Russia is interested in winning the minds of millions of Chinese and Koreans and Japanese, in promoting communism. It is sheer stupidity for us to keep on backing the county courthouse gang of machine politicians who now run China, led by Chiang Kai-shek, the gang which has aroused UNRWA officials even by wholesale thefts of American relief supplies. Our own General Stilwell could tell the touring congressman that we ought to think twice before handing over millions of dollars worth of guns and planes to Chiang Kai-shek. General Stilwell was forced out of China during the war because he tried to persuade Chiang to get rid of the grafters in the Chinese government. By keeping our Marines in China to back up Chiang in his civil war against the Chinese communists, we're not helping to achieve Chinese democracy. We're simply making inevitable more gains for the communists, just as in Greece. While we're about it, we might comment on an incident which is sure to affect the morale of America's occupation army in Europe. The army which, of course, is supposed to be educating Germans in democracy. Everyone knows the name of Colonel James A. Killian, the fellow who commanded that grim American army camp at Lichfield in England, where GIs were beaten and brutally mistreated. Colonel Killian, after denying that any such things happened to his knowledge, was found guilty but let off the other day in an army trial with a mere fine of $500 and a reprimand. As if this gentle wrist-slapping were not enough to disgust the average GI, Colonel Killian now has brought official court-martial charges against Captain Earl Carroll, a young officer who had once helped prosecute the guilty colonel. This latest bit of effrontery by Colonel Killian, if the army allows it, will be a sure way, obviously, to turn the stomachs of thousands of GIs overseas. Our occupation army will obviously feel very little like teaching democracy in Germany if it is confronted with such undemocratic arrogance in its own high command. And the Russians will be gaining another point in their argument to peoples overseas that we are really defenders of reaction. We must do far better in our campaign abroad to persuade the world that democracy is better than the Soviet way of life. It will be a hollow victory in the battle between Washington and Moscow if the king in Greece wins today.
You have just heard Carrie Longmire, ABC Washington commentator and foreign correspondent, substituting today for Orson Welles, who has been called to Mexico City on business. Your announcer is Jackson Weaver, and this is ABC, the American Broadcasting Company.